Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of my favorite films in the last couple years was the Robert Eggers film, The Witch, which I was very happy to see in a theater on the nice big screen because it was a visually sumptuous tale. And a fascinating exploration of this ancient archetype. So certainly one that goes back to antiquity, as well as the more familiar kind of Renaissance, early modern period, which is when the film was set. And I don't want to talk about it too much, especially if you haven't seen it, but one of the things that really struck me about that film that was very unusual for sort of horror or more art house horror films even, was the way that it combined the psychological dimension, where you could see the way that the individuals who were vexed by these witches were sort of creating this this vision in their minds out of their belief systems, their form of Christianity, the fact they were out in the wilderness, they'd been expelled from a Puritan camp in early New England, America. And at the same time, the film gave really rich visual proof that in some level the witches were real. And so it wasn't that they were saying that the witches were real and the people were just happened to have these psychological states of mind, is that there was this connection between how we see the world and how reality presents itself that I thought was really quite sophisticated for a film that I was seeing in a theater, let's put it that way. And it really made me think as well about the fact that we can still, that the witch remains a lively archetype, that there's still new facets to this figure, new ways to sneak up on both the scary side and the powerful side and the sexy side and the imaginative side, and all the different dimensions of this figure remain very active in our contemporary landscape. And so to help me suss this out, or to help us suss this out, I thought it would be great to bring Pam Grossman back to the show. We had Pam on a couple of years ago, and as I'm sure many of you know, she's probably longest known for the person behind Phantasmophile, which is a great blog that deals with esoteric and occult imagery, art, and design. I also know her as someone who co-organizes the Occult Humanities Conference, which I got to attend earlier this year. It already seems like it was years ago. How does that happen? And one of the things that happened alongside that conference was Pam's curated art show, Language of the Birds, Occult and Art, which was at NYU, and was really one of the best occult art shows I've ever seen in terms of combining contemporary visions from folks who are relatively unknown and were working with occult and esoteric inspiration in a variety of not always super obvious ways, which was nice to see. It's really easy to be cartoonish and overly explicit about the occult. So we had these new voices, as it were, visual voices, but alongside a lot of really terrific pieces from well-known folks, including artworks from people whose works I had only seen in reproduction before. That was really quite striking. So she's really done a great job of kind of revising our image of art, not so much underground occult art, but really how in the main streams of contemporary art throughout the 20th century, there's been always been a powerful esoteric and occult tendency that mainstream art critics actually took a long time to acknowledge and are only just acknowledging now. So she really works at this potent place between image and occult forces. And so with no further ado, Pam, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. Thank you so much for having me back. I always love talking to you.
Yeah, it's great. And now you're calling from your gig. I kind of like that you're at Getty Images right now, right?
Yeah, but this is my lunch break, Eric, and I think it's important that the powers that be take note of that.
Excellent. I'm glad you made that clarification. No, I say that partly right off the bat because I mean, one of the things that interests me about your work and your career is you know, I'm especially coming up. You know, I'm a little older than you, and I started getting interested in the occult when I was in my 20s in the 1980s. And most of the folks who were dealing with the occult then were in the underground. You know, they were like scruffy post-hippie, you know, crazy underground musicians, rainbow gathering heads, and all this kind of these kinds of characters. And you know, at that time, there was very few people in the academy who were interested in occult, certainly contemporary occultism. And it's just, you know, remarkable to me how much it's changed and how relatively open more, you know, mainstream isn't really the right word, but, you know, different zones of society have become towards the occult, whether that's the academy with you know, I'm going to an esoteric conference in a few days. And lots of young people there who are studying these things in scholarly contexts, or whether it's a more you know, mainstream society in the sense of people, you know, work in the work who aren't necessarily identifying themselves with the underground. I'm curious, just even in your life, whether that was always kind of the case. It always seemed like it was not a big deal to work in multiple worlds, or was that something you still had to kind of claim for yourself as you found your way through the professional world as well as the world of media in which you were pursuing your more occult interests?
That is actually one of the big questions of my life, and it's been something that I've been navigating for years now. I would love to say that it's all come really, really easily, but in fact, you know, it's something I've given a lot of thought to. You know, how do I integrate all of these different parts of myself? And frankly, I think that's the great question that most of us ask ourselves, you know, whether you're interested in things like the occult and magic, but you also have a day job and a gig that might not be, you know, related to that on the surface, at least, or any other interest that might not be necessarily exactly how you're, you know, keeping the lights on and feeding yourself. And what it comes down to for me is a few things. First and foremost, you know, I've never felt like I had to hide who I am or what my interests are. But that said, I'm very conscious of context. So, you know, for my day job, I'm the director of visual trends at Getty Images. I have a pretty public role here. And luckily, a lot of how I keep the lights on is about thinking about images and thinking about the ways in which images are used and how they change consciousness. Now, usually I'm studying, you know, image trends in advertising and in pop culture, but I would argue from kind of a Jungian perspective that it's all, you know, all part of the same sauce, right? It's about how images influence our perspectives and our perceptions. So I'm lucky in that my day job is, you know, there's a lot of overlap there between how I look at the world, you know, the material world, and how I look at the spiritual world. That said, I do have my personal practice and path. I also have all of the creative and personal projects that I do that are blatantly involved with magic and witchcraft and the occult. And, you know, that is something that I'm just mindful about the ways in which I talk about those things and to whom. You know, I don't think anybody needs to talk about their spiritual beliefs when they're at their day jobs. In most cases, it's not even appropriate. You know, I don't ask my coworkers what they believe in, and they don't, you know, really ask me. But that said, anybody who knows what I do outside of work, which again, I don't hide, and I certainly am really proud of, you know, they know what I'm into, and I have a lot of coworkers who come to my events, and they're my friends, and they support what I do, and they're interested in it. But I also do compartmentalize it somewhat. And all of that said, you know, I believe that our beliefs are things that we integrate, and it's who we are. And I'm lucky that a lot of the projects that I work on at Getty Images are in line with my own, moral compass and spiritual North Star. I do a lot of projects around, you know, how images can help break down gender stereotypes and show more images of empowered women and girls. And, you know, on the surface, we're talking about stock photography, but I would say it's just the other side of the coin in terms of talking about the divine femininity or witches or any kind of imagery construct that shows that females have worth and agency and power.
Well, yeah, speaking of females with worth and agency and power, of course, we started off talking about the witch, and I have a question for you about how you phrase your identity, at least in different contexts, how you language it, which is, it's one thing to say, I'm interested in, I'm interested in the occult, or I practice magic, but it's still another thing entirely to say, I am a witch. And that extra closeness of just saying, I am a witch, and not just leaving it there, or explaining it further, but it's a different move to make. And I'm curious whether in some circumstances you're comfortable saying that, or that you're always interested in keeping a little vagueness around that, or whether the witch itself is kind of a figure you both approach and then and sort of identify with, but at the same time kind of allow to be one step away or on the sort of borderlines of what your practice or even your kind of spiritual identity is.
Sure. I would say I am, again, conscious and mindful of how I use the word and to whom I am saying that word to, because it is so loaded. And it is a word that is important to me, and it's part of my identity. I mean, I will say to you and your audience, yes, I am a witch. And but that means different things to different people. What it means to me is, you know, I'm someone, even though I was raised Jewish, I am a practitioner of ritual and magic. I am pagan. And I also am somebody who believes that it's a word that should be reclaimed, and that there are so many layers to the word. There are a lot of negative associations. There are a lot of positive associations. I would argue that both halves of that make the whole, and that really fascinates me. And so it is a word that I do think of when I think of myself. That said, it's not a word I use when I introduce myself necessarily to people. You know, it sometimes comes up, certainly in the context of my day job. It's not a word I just kind of toss around. Once I get to know people better, it comes up. You know, it really depends. Then again, if I'm speaking about witchcraft or I'm speaking about the occult and art to that audience in that community, it's a word I use much more freely, because I know it's not going to, or I know it's most likely not going to be misunderstood or taken out of context. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, it's really interesting things are raised by that. I mean, one thing you started off talking about the negative associations and the positive associations, and how the figure really combines them. And what it makes me think of is, you know, on the one hand, you can say that over the last 40, 50 years, both with witchcraft and paganism, is that people have reclaimed these identities, reconstructed these identities as part of modern spiritual possibilities. And as such, they take part in the same kind of identity politics we see with other unusual subcultural identifications or gender relationships or sexual preferences, and the whole sort of gamut of things that were once looked down upon thrust out of conventional society that increasingly claim a space. And a lot of that reclaiming often takes the form of attacking the negative associations with of those characters. For example, you would say, you know, I'm a voodoo initiate, let's say. And, or, you know, wow, you say that and you invoke this whole set of incredibly negative, cartoonish, ridiculous associations from pop culture the last 100, 200 years. And so if you're saying, look, I'm going to make room for my identity as a voodoo practitioner, one of the first things you do is you attack all those negative stereotypes. You say, no, we don't do that. No, we don't do that. Or if we do animal sacrifice, it's under these conditions, and we always do this, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of what identity politics are about is attacking those negative stereotypes. But the witch is really interesting here, because there's something in precisely those traditional pop culture negative stereotypes that you want to keep alive, that's part of the figure, that's part of the mystery of it. And I mean, I just love to hear you talk a little bit more about, I mean, I didn't even mention, of course, the main reason we're having you on the show is you have this new wonderful, I don't know, would you call it sort of a manifesto, What is a Witch, that you did with this dynamite Canadian duo, Tin Can Forest, whose Baba Yaga book I had already been familiar with, but really just amazing, very occult, rich kind of illustrations that are really powerful. And throughout the book, you're playing with these in a kind of poetic way rather than a really discursive way. You're kind of introducing all these facets of the witch. And, of course, some of those negative associations are actually part of the power of the figure. So the last thing you'd want is a sort of like happy, fluffy, oh, a witch is just like all the other religious identities you have, and everyone's just, you know, sharing at the big table of religious diversity, and you're like, well, yes, but there's something to that side that's still kind of scary or threatening or disturbing. I'd love to hear you talk about, like, as someone who's actually kind of not just reflecting on the figure of the witch, but participating in its revisioning for our moment, how you balance these sort of associations that would wind a witch up in a horror movie.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for those lovely, lovely words about the book. I'm really proud of this. And, you know, when I was writing it, it was important to me that it invoked and celebrated all of the different facets of the archetype, because to your point, I think her complexity is what gives her potency. And I cannot be luckier in terms of whom I got to do the art for it, which is, as you mentioned, Tin Can Forest, who are Pat Shuchuk and her husband Marek Koluk. And they're this incredible collaborative couple who live in Canada and kind of operate out of this third mind space and the ways in which they make art together. And I'm just totally blown away by the artwork that they've created for it. So thank you for that. In terms of, you know, the different sides of the witch and the fact that she is very dark and very light, I mean, I think that is why she matters. And I think that's why she's, frankly, a really important feminist icon right now, because I think, you know, so much of what we think about when we think about powerful women, traditionally, it has to do with, oh, they're healing and they're gentle and they're loving and they're nurturing and they're beautiful and sensual. And that's all great. And yes, in fact, we are all those things. But I also think that when you're only talking about those fluffy, gentle, soft as petals aspects, you're actually, you know, only talking about half the story, and then you're not really celebrating a holistic character or person. And the fact of the matter is, we all have darkness in us and light in us. And, you know, I've often said, darkness and evil are not the same thing. And darkness is about sometimes being angry. It's about, you know, interfacing and honoring death. It's about protecting yourself. It's about being in pain and acknowledging your pain and your sadness. It's about being messy and imperfect. And, you know, I think we as human beings in general, but frankly, especially women who are so often expected to be perfect and beautiful and lovely all the time, I think it's really important that we are given permission, or at least, frankly, that we give ourselves permission to honor all of our complexity and shadow and mess alongside all of the quote-unquote positive things, too. And the other thing I just want to add is, you know, for all the quote-unquote negative things we say about witches, you know, that they cast spells and do hexes and, you know, can be very punishing, if you actually follow the stories of the witch, it is very rare that she actually hurts anybody for no reason. Usually she's cursing you because you have crossed a boundary of hers. You have stolen something from her garden, or you have, trespassed in her wood. You've eaten the candy from her house. You know, it's rare that she is actually on the offense or the attack. And I think having an icon of a woman who protects herself, and yes, who will bring the hammer down on you if you cross her, is a really, really important one. And it's one that I take to heart alongside all the healing and creative magic that witches are associated with too.
Yeah, there's also a dimension to the figure of the witch, and I'm thinking more here anthropologically in terms of, you know, real indigenous or pre-modern societies that have witches or figures that we would recognize as being continuous with the witch, is that the witch also is a kind of, has a side of her that you could describe as being a kind of social justice warrior, or at least a balancer, because one of the places you see witchcraft arise is when there are people in a village or a tribe who are kind of getting a little high on themselves, or who are taking too much power, or becoming too wealthy in a way in relationship to the rest of the tribe, and it's often the witch who's going to sort of bring them down a notch. There's obviously light and dark sides to that process as well, but there is a sort of sense that even though the witch is on the one hand sometimes a kind of isolated figure, she's on the edge of the tribe, she's in the forest, you know, people kind of avoid her on some level, there's also a way in which she helps maintain the, you know, ever elusive social equilibrium.
Absolutely. I love that, Eric, because it's really not a beloved job to be a social justice warrior. You know, you are both loved and hated at the same time, and you have to simply do what you think is the right thing to do. And so much of the witch is about trying to live in that balance and live in that harmony and try to live in line with your highest self, your highest truth, a higher power. And it's not an easy path, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the feminist side of it. I mean, one research project I had a couple of years ago, I really dove into sort of the origins of the explicitly feminist witch in the post-war world, and how that developed through the 60s and 70s and to today. And it was a wonderful study, because it was very interesting to see how, you know, witchcraft as a modern phenomenon begins in the, you know, 1940s, 1950s, and there's not too much of that kind of politics going on there. You know, a lot of it is pretty, some of it has some pretty traditional aspects to the role that women play, even if they're praised and celebrated in some ways and have a lot of power within the organizations. It's not really feminism in the way we would recognize it today, but then in the 60s things start to really heat up. But one of the first groups to really grab onto the witch as a figure of feminist revolt didn't really come from paganism. They came from the political movements of the late 60s and were kind of inspired by the Yippies. And this is, of course, the group which, and I'm talking about them probably so I can just say what the acronym stands for, which is Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. They are a wonderful group. I don't know if you want to riff on them at all, but just about how, in the 60s and 70s in particular, and then if you look at paganism with Z. Budapest and her Dianic witchcraft, which is explicitly feminist, female only, largely lesbian, and very, very militant. You know, they're right off the bat, they're like going and, sending people with rape victims into the police, into the institutions so that they can make sure that they don't get harassed. I mean, they're really activist right off the bat. So there's this really powerful militancy at that time. I'd love to hear you talk about that, what its legacy is, how that still affects things today, or how things have changed.
Well, I think the thing to note about witch, the group that you mentioned, is that there was a wit and a sense of humor there as well, and also quite a bit of, a performative aspect. There was theater, there were, rituals and, kind of protests and activist moments that they staged and enacted in public. And I love that crossover between theater and activism and magic, because I would argue that they're all kind of different flavors of the same thing. And I love this idea of women who want to enact social change literally wearing the cloak of the witch and doing it in kind of this trickstery, mischievous way. And yet there being such power and conviction behind their intentions and their actions. So I love thinking about that, because there's so much blur and bleed between all these different spheres. But I think that, the feminist piece of the witch is one that gets debated about a lot. And I think it's important that we also talk about, the historical veracity of the witch, because that's something that comes up all the time. And what I'm talking about is everything from debates that come up in the community between, quote unquote, trad witches or traditional witches who believe or know that they're from some unbroken line or bloodline of witchcraft and tradition. And the trad witches don't necessarily like witchcraft being appropriated. There are some people who think Dianic witchcraft is a little bit offensive because, it's, oh, I like this goddess from this culture and that goddess from that, and I'll put a little sprinkle of Kali on top, And so there's a lot of these different debates. And what I always say about it is that stories are fluid and they want to be known and they want to be embodied and they want to morph. And so to me, the fact that this character of the witch or this archetype or energy of the witch is related to by all of these different pockets of people and many, many more than the ones I just mentioned, I think is very, to me, very unifying. And it gratifies me to see the fact that she is sometimes used in this playful, activist, statement-making way. And she's also used to tell stories and to be a star of a horror movie or to be a costume that Beyoncé wears in a music video. And she's also a crown someone wears when they're enacting a ritual and taking part in, their own personal spellcraft. And to me, none of them is more legitimate or illegitimate than the others.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that issue of appropriation, because I know you've thought about it, and it's a big one in all sort of sides of certainly the kind of alternative spirituality or alternative religion in the last, 50 years plus, where people who are attempting to get outside the weight of their given religious tradition turn towards others, turn towards things that are exotic or underground or fantastical. And in so doing, often to in varying widely varying ways and with widely varying degrees of sensitivity, appropriate things that really, you know, aren't naturally their own. And the witch is here also an interesting figure because you can be relatively strict about where this figure we're talking about arises from, at least within the Western imagination. You can talk about the historical reality of witchcraft, the historical reality of the creation of witchcraft in terms of the Renaissance and the early modern period, where a lot of those images sort of get in our minds, where we have the woodcut images of witches flying with brooms and gathering at Sabbats and, you know, kissing the devil's ass and all this kind of, you know, we really have this very European figure. And then I think part of the appeal of the figure of the witch for a lot of Europeans, Euro-Americans in the 20th century was that it was, while being very different and very outside and very countercultural, also a figure that could be found within a certain sense of tradition of where, you know, white folks have come from. Now, of course, everything's very different, and the witch has very wide boundaries. If you want to go anthropologically, like I did before, you can talk about the figure of the witch in all sorts of cultures. And in your book, you sort of kind of balance these two views by saying that at one point the witch says, "I'm the daughter of Hecate, of Isis, of Inanna. I'm the child of Ixchief." I don't know how to pronounce that.
Ixchel.
Ixchel, Jiwangmu, and Caradwin, Kali, etc., etc. So you are kind of showing how this figure opens up into much larger archetypal world of powerful religious or mythological females. How do you kind of skate that difference between a figure that is in some sense kind of deeply European and at the same time transcultural?
Sure. So when we're talking about the traditional image of the witch, the one with the pointy hat, the one who rides a broom, that can be traced to really the 15th century. It's the advent of the printing press that, you know, replicated words and images. I mean, I'm thinking about everything from pamphlets and books like The Witch's Hammer or Malleus Maleficarum. And that came out in 1486, and that is the source of the lovely quote, "All witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which in women is insatiable." Who doesn't love that? And then, you know, there's actually a pamphlet also coming out of Germany called, and I'll probably mangle the pronunciation of this. It was by Ulrich Molitor, and it was called De Lamis et Pythonicus Mulieribus, which roughly translates to "On Female Witches and Seers." And this is a pamphlet that came out in 1489, and it actually had 6 woodcuts. And this is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, images of witch-like figures riding on what were actually cooking forks, and which later morphed into the brooms that we're all familiar with. And it showed images of, you know, a woman embracing a devil, and the woman has long, loose hair, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And this little book, it had more than 20 editions that circulated from around, like, 1490 to, I want to say, 1510, thereabouts. And then these books and pamphlets were taken out by the artists of the time, so Albrecht Dürer and, you know, his artistic disciples then started kind of duplicating and retranslating these images. I mean, the witch is a meme, if you will, and all of this kind of roots back to being this anti-Christian figure, right? And at the time, you know, this idea that women were lusty, this idea that women could be curious or could be seeking power or a source of power was deeply threatening and deeply disturbing to the good Christian people of the time. And so, you know, she is very much in line with the devil figure. She's seen copulating with the devil, kissing his ass. She's seen riding backwards on goats and going to Sabbaths and dancing naked, you know, in front of a fire. And I love this version of the witch, and she's certainly the one that's, you know, taken flight, if you'll forgive the turn of phrase. You know, and been made very, very popular, which I love. And, you know, she certainly changed shape many times over the years. But that said, I think it's important to acknowledge that the idea of a magical woman or a liminal woman is one that goes back hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, before the 15th century. There were female priestesses, there were midwives and healers, and of course, you know, the stories and the myths that have been being told about goddesses and female deities with power, some of whom are very angry and very scary, others of whom are very beautiful and kind. And so to me, the root of this story of the magical woman begins with mythology and begins with, you know, the religious stories. You know, I mean, we can trace it back as far as Inanna, who is, many historians say, you know, the first, kind of idea of there being a female deity, who then morphed into and branched off into, you know, Lilith figures or was related to the Lilith figure, who then, you know, took all these different shapes. And of course, we're still, you know, planted in the Fertile Crescent area of the world. And goddesses are in every culture you can imagine, as you well know. So to me, it's important to trace her spiritual lineage and her artistic lineage. You know, I didn't want to stop at the 15th century because I think the seeds for her have been planted so many years earlier.
Yeah, and one thing just to point out, we haven't really spoken about in detail about Tin Can Forest and their particular style, and since you're really good at talking about images and art, I'd love to talk about that a little bit. But one, just sort of a gesture towards this is there's, you know, to my mind, perhaps the most powerful image ever of a goddess figure with that kind of witchy element, which is this sort of famous figure of Inanna, where she's standing on these two maybe lions. She's flanked by two probably owls. She's got wings, and she has these talon feet that give her a little bit of this spooky shape-changing character. And it's a, you know, famous image that a lot of people have seen. But the Tin Can Forest, they kind of play with this image and sort of update it and change it in different images in the book as a way of kind of talking about. So, for example, in one image, she's got the classic conical hat instead of the peculiar headdress that she wears in the Sumerian glyph. And so there is this kind of sense of a kind of a deep continuity, which it seems to me, isn't that partly what your, you know, kind of part of your mission in a way is to acknowledge the continuity and allow these resonances to kind of feed back through time or feed forward through time, and help the figures that are so attractive to people for a lot of different reasons today gain a little bit more resonance and historical substance.
That's a really beautiful and insightful way of putting it, for sure. And one of the things I was so thrilled about when I saw the images for the book is how Tin Can Forest, they just got it. I mean, they immediately understood that I was trying to show, you know, the elasticity of this archetype. And they then were able to show the echoes of her, of this magical, complicated, powerful woman, by also riffing on those different images and just the way you said. And it's interesting too, because, you know, Pat and Merrick are both, they both have roots in Eastern Europe, and they're very deeply, deeply steeped in Slavic culture and folklore. You know, as you mentioned, they have this incredible comic called Baba Yaga and the Wolf. And they're a lot of the textile patterns and a lot of the sigils and imagery that they use come straight from that region and straight from, you know, the stories that they grew up with. And that's this beautiful thread that they brought to the comic, which I really, really loved. And so, you know, the image you're talking about, some listeners might know the image. It's what's frequently referred to as the Burney relief, and it's in the British Museum. And they have named her the Queen of the Night. They think she might be Inanna, she might be Lilith, she might be Erish Kegel, she might be some combination of all three. And she is, you know, not that particular relief, but that image of her, that character or being or deity, is arguably the oldest image and story that we have of this, you know, witchly, magical, dark, light, powerful female being. And so the fact that they were able to take her and keep changing her costume and, you know, keeping that pattern throughout the book, but sometimes she sort of morphs into like almost like a Mother Mary figure at times. Sometimes she is wearing a pointy hat. Sometimes she has these kind of like spider webs that she's weaving. Sometimes she has multiple arms, just like a Kali figure or other Hindu deities. And I love that because It's this subtle visual spell that they're weaving, which is telling, you know, a parallel story that the words are telling.
It's funny. I didn't realize that classic relief image hadn't really been identified. I know that the Queen of the Night was a name associated, but that kind of makes it almost more interesting because it's such a powerful figure that you're like, this is somebody. It's not just some, you know, some single artist like little doodle. I mean, it's really quite powerful, and yet we can't exactly locate it. And so in a way, it kind of reminds us of the mystery that's going on around all of these figures we're talking about, which in turn reminded me of one of my favorite lines in your piece, or in your, if we can call it a manifesto, if your work, What is a Witch, is she says, "I'm detective to a mystery I never once solved." And that really got me because it reminded me, I guess, as my part of my own life as a researcher, how, you know, on the one hand, I go, what do I think I'm going to get when I, you know, I keep studying and I study history and I study philosophy and study iconography and, like, you know, really thinking hard about how do we think about these mysteries. And yet, in a way, I don't really want to know the answer because because it's something that continually unfolds. So it's sort of absurd in a way, but it's also kind of beautiful. I think it says something about, you know, the detective is a very modern figure. You know, the detective is not an ancient or pre-modern figure. The detective is a 19th, 20th century archetype, and it's sort of an archetype of reason, of rationality, of being able to put together clues and to come up with a coherent story that really says something very true and very concrete about the world. And in some way, that's part of the work that you do as a writer, as a thinker, as a teacher, as someone who puts together, writes copy on the sides of these images in curated art shows, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, you know, there's some way in which that too, it gets swallowed up by the mystery. And however much we study this marvelous relief in the British Museum and understand its composition, yada, yada, there's still this kind of unknown that weaves through the story. So I'm kind of curious, just for you, how you feel when you're balancing the sort of fundamental mystery and the continued work of reflection, of thinking, of writing, of researching, of historical work.
I find the tension to be just delicious. I really do. And, you know, it's interesting because most of the academics and scholars and artists that I know who, you know, have rigorous study and research that goes into their work, they're also more often than not practitioners. And I think that's lovely, because I think seekers are just the best people, you know, people who are curious and who want to learn and who want to, you know, follow this path of scholarship and study, they're just interesting people who are looking for meaning in their lives. And, you know, that's my favorite kind of person to be around. You know, that said, I do think it's important that this history is acknowledged. You know, for so long, and I think we might have talked about this last time, Eric, but for so long, academia would not even acknowledge that occult or magical ideas have had influence on, you know, so many of our favorite bodies of work and so many of our favorite creators. And I'm really happy to see that history being, you know, revised or resurfaced, I suppose is a better word. You know, we can talk about like the abstract expressionists. We can talk about people like Jackson Pollock and Rothko and, you know, a lot of, you know, Kandinsky, a lot of the most canonized artists who had these esoteric and spiritual intentions and saw themselves as channels between the immaterial world and the material world. And yet, you know, when I was learning about it, you know, studying art history, there was very little mention of it. And if it was a little bit with a wink and an eye roll. And so I'm really, really happy to see the influence of these magical ideas and of magical history in general be acknowledged. And I really, really think it's important to legitimize that path of study and to see, you know, universities around the world start to embrace this and start to come up with new fields of study that one can endeavor to go down. So I think that's wonderful. All of that said, you know, I don't think we're ever going to know the answers. And I love that. I love that there's always more to learn. There's always more questions to ask. There's always more things to not know. And that actually gives me sustenance, and it makes me feel that we're part of a really marvelous life and marvelous world or layers of worlds. And I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating time in terms of the scholarship and the shifts in historical memory and the availability of these counter-narratives for so many sides of society, even in academia, which is like one of the most secular parts of the contemporary world. So even if a lot of the scholarships are scholars are walking that line of, you know, they're not, you know, trying to make value characterizations, the fact that this material is out there, I think, is really significant and really reflects something much broader, which is that in a lot of ways, the esoteric isn't esoteric anymore. It's exoteric. If you're just with a little bit of curiosity, you can find, you know, most anything you want online or in the bookstore. I mean, the amount of previously hidden or unknown material that is available now, and not just available, but sort of celebrated, used as part of popular culture, you know, where you have esoteric icons or sigils that make their way onto T-shirts when the people who are designing don't even know what they necessarily mean, that all of these powerful occult images and icons are now part of the sort of postmodern mix of free-floating signifiers out of which we try to make some kind of meaning or have fun or just make something groovy happen. And so that raises this other kind of issue, which is that, you know, it's, you know, I'm not really sure what the best metaphor to use, dilution or a sort of a kind of a loss of the aura, or a sort of you know, dissolution of the power of the underground or the esoteric or the unknown in the sense of being not something you're going to find out about in class. How do you see that happening now? I mean, how do, because I know that some, we've talked about this as well, that some, you know, practitioners feel that there is this sort of danger of loss of the power of some of these things as they become part of mainstream culture. Is that a concern you share, or do you think that that's a wrong way to think about it?
It's a concern that I understand, but I truly, truly, truly know, if I know anything, it's that there is plenty of mystery left. And I think, you know, people who are a little bit miserly about secrets, you know, so to speak, secrets, you know, I think that there's a lack of imagination there. This knowledge is for everybody, but it also is so individual and so intensely personal that even if you learn many codes or many languages or many symbols, you know, you can't know magic unless you do it. And if you do magic, you know that there are things that are just so ineffable and that transcend language, that one experiences, that I really don't believe that suddenly, oh, you know, the secret recipes have been revealed, and so, you know, there's some kind of threat to mystery. I absolutely don't believe that. And, you know, I also think there's always been this back and forth between how much do we share and how much do we keep for ourselves, or how much do we just keep for this select group versus how much the public knows. It makes me think of that line from the Lew Welch poem Theology that goes, "Guard the mysteries, constantly reveal them." And I just love that, you know, and I suppose that's how I feel. Certainly, I'm protective of my own practice because it's very personal and it's very private. On the other hand, I think that these symbols and this knowledge wants to be known. And if you want to know it, then more power to you. You know, I believe that this is for everyone. And you know what? Some people are going to be interested in this because it's trendy right now, and then they're going to toss it off and they'll move on. And that's fine. That's how trends work. Other people are going to discover an image somewhere, and then it's going to, you know, lead them down this incredible path of meaning and insights. And that's wonderful. And I would never want to, you know, keep anybody from opening that gate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all, it's also reflective of much larger shifts and changes in our society as we change what privacy means, as we change what secrets mean. You know, if we look at how secrets are revealed and how much of our sense of like major historical events like the Snowden revelations or the Panama Papers or whatever is the sense that there are these secrets that sort of sustain you know, the contemporary reality as it is, and that their revelation is part of the bringing to light of things. But then there's also a kind of loss of that as we lose our own personal lives, or we mediate ourselves so thoroughly that we lose touch of that space of privacy, of interiority that has been historically part of what it means to be, you know, a subject, to be individual. And I think that the way that esotericism is changing is reflective in a lot of ways of these larger issues, which is, you know, probably why there's a connection between esotericism and conspiracy theory, for example, as well as codes and ciphers and things that are really relevant in very non-occult ways today. So I think that that's reflective of a much deeper change that we're going through. And I love that Lew Welch quote. I've forgotten it. I remember reading that long ago, but I've forgotten it. And I think it's it also points to the that there is a power as well in the giving away of secrets, that we want to think that the power is in holding them, but it's also in watching yourself desire to hold on to the secret, to be miserly about it, and then let it go.
Absolutely. And, you know, just on a final note, I would say that personal practice is so important, but the deeper I get into this world, the more I realize the magic and art and meaning that can happen in collaboration and in community. So I'm thrilled that my path, for example, has led me to Tin Can Forest and led me to you and led me to all these amazing people that I've been fortunate enough to collaborate with and make more art and magic in the world happen together.
Well, that's a wonderful place to wind up. So, Pam, thanks so much for joining us again on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Absolutely. Just once again, Pam's new book is What is a Witch? Done with Tin Can Forest. Highly recommended. It's very, very beautiful. And you can find out more about her on pamgrossman.com. And just a reminder that there's a big backlog of Expanding Minds now. I think we have definitely well over 250. And you can find those on prn.org or my own technosis.com website. So until next time, keep your minds open.